Without further ado, I'm going to welcome Sarah to introduce Meg.
Well, I don't quite know how to introduce Meg, and in fact, I've had a hard time trying to come up with how to introduce Meg, because every time I think about introducing Meg, I realize that it would be indelicate in some way to sort of, I mean, Meg to me is one of the most amazing people I've ever met.
Oh, my goodness.
And I just don't, any declarative sentence would sort of be like a bull in a china shop. It would just, so Meg comes across so beautifully in her poetry and in her books and in her work. And so I think I don't know how many people do not know that Meg is an incredibly wonderful, honest poet. And not only does she write wonderful books for adults and for children, young adults, but an added bonus with the young adult books is at the end there's a tutorial on the various types of poetry that she writes. So if you want to know what a villanelle is or how to, you know, or how to write free verse, I mean, she just has wonderful, wonderful stories and then an educational component to it also. She is also the director, the founding director for what is probably going to soon be putting Iowa out of business, the Pine Manor MFA program in creative writing, which is growing stronger and stronger year by year. More and more well-known authors are going there and coming out of Meg's program at Pine Manor. And so if anybody knows of an up-and-coming author who needs just, you know, a little help, it's a wonderful place. And the other thing that maybe not everybody knows about is Meg's connection with ravens. And I just want to say that wherever Meg goes, there are ravens. And it is, I have been climbing with her in southern New Hampshire where there should not be ravens. And all of a sudden we look up and there are two pairs of ravens swooping around over us. We went out to Halibut Point, and there was what we were sure was a raven. It turned out not to be a raven, but it was a bird impersonating a raven.
Just for Meg.
Just for Meg. Anyway, I think we're in for a wonderful treat having Meg read her poetry and discuss, and I'm looking forward to it. And so.
Thank you so much, Sarah, and thank you for coming. I know there's a lot of competing events happening tonight all around Gloucester and Cape Ann, so we were thinking there might be just, you know, three of us or, you know, an Annie, you know, so I'm really happy to see you, and I'm also glad that it's a small crowd because I've been working on a project for the last 2 years that I call the Bird Poems. And they're all inspired by, there's a book that I actually brought with me. It's called 100 Birds and How They Got Their Name by a woman named Diana Wells. And it's in here somewhere. Here it is. So I think one of the hardest things for any writer is to sit and look at a blank page. And poets go through this a lot more often than fiction writers or nonfiction writers because what we write is very short. So, you know, prose writers can just kind of go back to the desk and pick up the last place they left off, where poets are often having to face that blank page over and over and over again. So I love a good prompt. I love something that's going to get me going. And I heard about this book on NPR probably 10 or 12 years ago, and I bought it right away. But it wasn't until 2 years ago that I was going up to my little writing cabin up in the White Mountains of New Hampshire, and I brought the book with me with the idea that I would just read the description. I'd start at the beginning with Albatross. And it's a really great book, so there's just these little descriptions. They don't go on for more than 2 or 3 pages. There's a little sketch of the bird, and there's some history about the bird. There's some characteristics of the bird and how it got its name. And I would read the description, write down the name of the bird at the top of the page, so it's not blank, and use something in that description as a leaping off point. So many of the poems aren't really like about the bird, but the bird was my jumping off point. And I haven't read any of those poems in public, but I thought I'd read a few of those tonight. And that's why I'm really glad it's a small group, because as you can imagine, that's a really terrifying thing, to read something that everybody's nodding because you're all writers, you know, that's so new and raw still. So, and still, you know, being revised. So I know already that you guys are going to support me when I read those poems to you. So I just finished the 100th poem at the end of August. So it took me 2 years to write all 100. And my hope is that maybe by the end of the revision process, I'll have 30, 35... You know, I don't know yet how many I'll have that I think are real keepers. I've thrown out a lot already, and then there's some that are on the maybe pile, and then some I've actually managed to publish already. So I'm now going to put that project aside to start on my third young adult novel in verse, because that's due next May, and I haven't started it yet. But I think that's going to be good for the bird poems, because I can just set it aside for that amount of time, and then when I come back to it, you know, I'm going to have fresh eyes and a fresh perspective on all of those, and then hopefully, you know, have a manuscript ready to send off. So I don't know if I should read. I was going to read, like, for about 35 minutes. Is that too long for a group like this?
We'll let you know.
Okay. Yeah. That's what we'll do.
When starts snoring.
Yeah. And then, you know, if people have questions or they want to chat, I just keep a list of what I'm going to read. That's the Monadnock Writers Group, not the Gloucester. Okay, and I'm already going to change some of what I'm going to do. So just in the spirit of birds, and when I was thinking about what bird poems I would read, I figured, well, I have to read at least a couple that are kind of sea birds, right, for obvious reasons. But I thought I would start with an old poem from my first book, An Unkindness of Ravens, which is called A Sculpture of Gulls. So little did I know that I would be writing all these bird poems when I was writing about my ravens. The raven poems make up kind of the center of this book. And raven kind of comes in all kinds of guises and disguises, and is a real trickster figure. But this is a short little poem. Looks like that. I like to see what poems look like often when I'm going to hear them read. So this is Sculpture of Gulls. They are riding the crest of a wave that never quite breaks. One gull flies just above the other and slightly behind, as if he could protect his mate from the past or a possible fury overhead, disguised now as a cloud, white as sea. She worries more about what lies ahead, the beach and its dependable shifting, the huge blue swell beneath her, the depth of its insatiable thirst. What they know about the wind holds them. What they are learning about each other makes them cry out, startled. And I'm going to read just one other poem from this book. Yesterday was the 23rd anniversary of my father's death. And that was an event that really rocked my world when it happened. So this is a poem called Second Thought, and it's in four short sections. So the first section is in tercets, lines of three. The second is a haiku. And the third section is a truncated villanelle, where I cut off the bottom of the villanelle. And then the last section is sonnet-like. And it's called On Second Thought, and it's was written for my father. On Second Thought. I'll just pause between the sections. I was wrong about happiness. I thought if I just knew where to look, it would be easily retrievable. Like a hairbrush I discovered I lost between the cushions of the couch, or the name of someone I used to know. When did I stop knowing it? I thought it would follow me when I left the house in LaGrange, that like my childhood memories, happiness was safely contained in the photograph of me and the neighborhood kids wearing cone-shaped birthday hats with elastic strings under our chins. But now I look at those pictures and I think about who took them. I think I hated how that string cut into my jaw left a temporary scar. I notice for the first time the girl not eating cake, not smiling in her black and gray, though it must have been a yellow or red hat. I can't recall her name, but wonder what she knew. How did she know it? I thought by now my body would demand less, not scream, I want, I want. I was wrong to think language could save me, or save you, for that matter. I see how words are their own truth, while mine dies with me. Once I believed childhood would be a cross of gold around my neck, my own hallowed relic. I wouldn't need language to save me. I thought the body, I thought memory would be dependable, that somehow, like words, they'd form their own truth. But my truth dies with me, because I've written poems that might have made you happy, but you'll never see. I realize now I was wrong to think language could save me. These words form their own truth. Mine dies with me. I was wrong about memory and the body. I discover my hairbrush squeezed for months in a crevice of the couch and find several long brown strands and one short, black, graying. Then I'm 25 again, kneeling on the hospital bed, gently brushing his hair, saying, "Am I brushing too hard, Dad? Let me use my brush." Saying, "You know I'm the only one with just the right touch." Now I pull his hair from my brush and place it in my mouth. His cells break down, become my own before I even swallow. Tomorrow people will say, "You look so much like your father." Okay. And since we just had another kind of anniversary of September 11th, I was living in Manhattan on September 11, 2001, and never really thought that I would write about that experience, except for there was one little poem that I'll read to you that I wrote pretty quickly that just came from standing on the roof of my building and just watching downtown burn, essentially. I could see the Twin Towers from my bedroom. From my writing desk was at the window facing south, and that was my view. And it really wasn't until I moved to New Hampshire in 2005 that I really started seeing 9/11 appear in a lot of my poems. And at that point, I just figured, well, we're at war, and how can I, you know, not as an artist, you know, talk about this experience from what my limited experience was. I didn't lose anybody close to me, but I had friends. A good friend lost her father, and, you know, knew a lot of people who lost people. So this is September 12th, 2001, view of downtown Manhattan from my bedroom window, and it's a tiny, just tiny little poem, and it's all metaphor, really. So, view of downtown Manhattan from my bedroom window. This is, you know, how do you get your mind around something like that? And this is me trying to get my mind around what I was seeing or what I wasn't seeing. The amputee insists her legs are still down there. She feels them burning. She knows when the smoke clears, they will be standing. And we are still living in the days of Code Orange, although you don't hear so much now about all the code colors that are supposed to make us very afraid. But this is called In the Days of Code Orange because I thought, oh, by the time I read this, you know, we're going to be way beyond that. Yeah. So this is a sonnet. In the Days of Code Orange. Terrorists might take the Empire State Building next. Might take you or me or the red eye to L.A. Our fears escalate like the news anchor's tits. We're not sure if they're real or not. The men in black keep such secrets secured in the public's interest. Yet they're never hung up by facts. Meanwhile, a woman dies cold in the park. An underemployed chef is driving a cab. A foster mother starves the boys in her care. The anthrax assassin sits tight in his lab. They'd drill ground zero if oil were there. Love, let's live by a code the color of wine. We have this cup. In so little time. Okay. I will read like one or two other 9/11 poems, but let's read Sandpipers, shall we? I'm going to have a glass of wine for that. Not the whole glass. Sit.
Speaking of wine.
Okay. Yeah, speaking of wine, that was a good idea. Okay, so... here we go, you guys. This is Sandpipers. Looks like this, like a block kind of like poem, and it's probably about 30 lines. And it was, this is, I guess it could be anywhere, East Coast, but it was really thinking about Maine, where I've spent a lot of time too. Sandpipers. We walked the beach every morning, sometimes when the horizon was just a pink salmon glow. Those first few weeks, the sandpipers threw themselves in the air when we approached. The gulls didn't care, stood their ground, especially when haggling over a smashed clam or crust of something stolen from who knows where. That early, the tide was always out. Sand hard but easy on our feet all the way to the break wall and back. Sandpipers worked the edge of surf, waiting for each wave to retreat, then fast forwarding on those little stick legs, beaks working the beach like sewing machines. they made us laugh. At last, they got used to our daily going by, the way city squirrels do, or pigeons in the parks. I'd left the city and a broken marriage or two behind. Your wounds were sleepless, not the kind you could drown like kittens in a burlap bag. That never works, you said. Sometimes I saw the scratches, holes where teeth had punctured skin. Sometimes I swallowed an ocean, but could never hold it in. Each day we'd begin again. Now we know the sandpipers pretend they are our friends. The Godwit, Dowitcher, Willet, the dun-colored Dunlin. Sandpipers. They're so cute. Oh! All right, this is one that Sarah and Shep know. And I have to say, Sarah and Shep have just become two of the most dear people in my life. And it's really because of them that I have this Gloucester connection. We met in 2010, which was a really very difficult year for me, because I met Sarah and Shep about 2 weeks after my mother died. And I had won this award that brought me to New England and the opportunity to meet them. And Alyssa East, if anybody knows Dogtown, she was there too. So it was really Alyssa who knew Sarah and Shep who got us all together. And I'm so grateful to you both for your friendship and for getting to know Gloucester, which is such a cool place, because my husband and I are fantasizing about living here now. So Sarah and Shep, I just decided to read this poem since I sent it to them, and they seem to like it. So this isn't a seabird, but it's a scarlet tanager. And this is a scarlet tanager dated 1893, which is when Dvorak wrote his American Quartet in F major. So a lot of the poems have little epigrams from 100 Birds and how they got their names. So this one is saying that Antonin Leopold Dvorak incorporated the song of the scarlet tanager, a bird not found in the old world, into his American Quartet in F. So Scarlet Tanager, 1893. And he had, you know, come to this country and really loved it and was pretty inspired, I think, in his music. After too much New York City noise, off-key and birdless, Dvorak rode out to Iowa, that little Bohemia, to find himself a little scherzo. He'd already written his requiem, married his true love's sister. What he needed then was something molto vivace, something quirky, full of offbeats and cross rhythms, something American. Enter the scarlet tanager. No matter Thoreau disliked the bird's harsh notes, and his own wife said it sounded like a robin with a sore throat. From an oak's green canopy came the high, interrupting strain of a violin on fire. Next came the second violin, a viola, a cello, a gapped pentatonic composed by nature, a scarlet-plumed opus, folk-like but stranger. Next came an American quartet in F major.
Okay. And since we're going to say goodbye to summer in, what, 2 days? Isn't September 20? Yeah. So I thought I'd read a country summer blues poem. And this was written pretty soon after I moved from New York City to New Hampshire. And it's something that I
tend not to read in the town that I live in. And you'll see why. And summer, snow, and new wonder are flowers, annual flowers. Country summer blues. Something small, bless you.
Thank you.
Is that the only one? Usually I have two.
I think you have at least two. Yeah, I think that was it.
All right, we scared them out of you. Country summer blues. Something small and brown is nesting in the bluebird's box. The dog won't cool himself in the plastic pool, even though we showed him how. Jay's picked all the raspberries, so we don't have to. One red leaf, cruel forecaster. What we thought were asters, meadow rue. 3 dry weeks seared the summer snow and new wonder. Neighbors warned we're fools to plant purple lilacs where the woodpile should go. We watch out for ticks and the sheriff who's nicknamed the Nazi. We stick to the rules and nod when we see him, as country folk do. He's gone now, finally. That. Okay, so this is a poem that started as kind of a tribute to a college professor. And it's called George Says Stop Writing About Yourself. And so I challenged myself to write a poem with no I in it. So that was their original title, was Poem with No I in It. It started failing so miserably that I kind of did the opposite. But then by the end, it really surprised me with how it ended. And so it's dated New York, December 2001, just so you know, for historical reasons, you know, where it is. And you already know, you know, where I was living and where I was situated. So George says, stop writing about yourself. New York, December 2001. This one's for George, who urged, take off those shit-kicker boots. Leave your husband wrapped in the scroll of last night's sheets. Forget your mother sipping a cigarette, a Dugan's Dew. Forget your other mother, your other father, too. And the one you last saw in a coffin, not looking at all like himself. So much not him, you couldn't bear to be near that body. Forget your first kiss, how it sounded like peanut butter, tasted like a train. Stop talking about the Alabama slammers and 4 blue whales, or those men you drove crazy with your push him, pull him love. And don't speak of babies, about not having them, or the ugly one who's so much a part of your nights she must be real, her mongrel face breaking into sadness. Don't talk about holding her above your head, calling her sweet girl, mama's girl, how she almost smiles. Just for George. This poem looks beyond sea monkeys and that first Louisville slugger. It opens the window to the stench, 3 months now, of that smell, man-made, human, wafting from downtown. This poem is in the street, where war does its thing. See, there's a man walking up Broadway. His shoes, suit, eyelashes, lips covered in dust that used to be a building. Okay. I guess I picked this poem for Sarah. I used to own a really great pickup truck. This is kind of my ode to my pickup truck. But it's called On Learning That Henry Ford Was an Anti-Semite. And I was reading a biography of Henry Ford, and I had no idea that he was really collaborating with the Nazis. And Hitler had a photograph of Henry Ford hanging in his office.
I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Wow.
On learning that Henry Ford was an anti-Semite. And I'll use the word a paean, which the poets in the room would know is a metrical term of one stressed and three unstressed syllables. And I'll mention the Frost Place, which is up in the White Mountains of New Hampshire. Now I am ashamed I bought that pickup truck brand new off the lot in 1989, and a custom cap to match the F-150 Supercab, alpine green with chestnut trim. She saved my life, Large Marge, when I fell asleep and took out a tamarack and stone wall. She kept me dry in Shenandoah when a creek swallowed my tent. She never lost her nerve climbing Titusville's icy hill. She carted a winter's worth of wood from Rhinebeck to Germantown, a piano from Poughkeepsie to LaGrange, and a paean of poets, one stressed, three unstressed, from the Kinsman to the Frost Place for readings, then back for more booze. It wasn't a Dodge or a GM, but that truck paid its dues. Did I say ashamed? I meant never again. Okay, four more. So this is the title poem from the book Home By Now. Home By Now. New Hampshire air curls my hair like a child's hand curls around a finger. Children? No, we tell the realtor, but maybe a dog or two. They'll bark at the mail car, Margaret's Chevy Supreme, and chase the occasional moose here in this place where it's code green from sun up, meaning go ahead and feel relieved. The terrorists are back where you left them on East 20th Street and Avenue C. In New York, we stocked our emergency packs with whistles and duct tape. In New England, precautions take a milder hue. Don't say pig on a lobster boat or paint the hull blue. Your friends in the city say they'll miss, but don't blame you. They still cringe each time a plane's overhead, one ear cocked for the other shoe. And I thought after the Boston bombing, like, well, there goes that poem. So in New England now, precautions don't necessarily take a milder hue either, you know, but so it was. Okay. So this is ibis, which is a wading bird, W-A-D, wading bird. And there's two little epigraphs from 100 Birds and How They Got Their Names. The first one, I always feel like I have a lisp when I say this, Thoth, the Egyptian god of wisdom and learning, had the body of a man and the head of an ibis. And the 16th century Swiss naturalist Conrad Gesner named the Waldrap ibis from the German wald, wood, and rap, raven, because of its raven-like croak. The Waldrap ibis, I can say that. So this is ibis. Her first mistake was trusting a god with the body of a man and the head of an ibis. People said he was old and bald and croaked like a raven, desired only shrimp and flies. But no. No, he was fine and smelled of salt. He knew her names, the one she was born with and the one she was given. Knowledge, he said, is a pond awake with fish. When he stripped her on its mossy bank and lured her in, she understood. Lily pads tangled around their knees. Her body was a map his hands had drawn. Beyond clear blue sky, she saw the moon, full, and stars in their constellations. If only she'd been satisfied. For wisdom, he had to carry her to shore, lay her down. She imagined the earth would open, reveal its golden center. But his bill was sharp. She thought he would be gentle. Yet with each peck, he drove her deeper, deeper, until she knew he had never truly been a waiting bird or bastard child. He was God of a heaven where all the angels' bodies were broken. All right. One short one from here, and then I'm going to end you with one more bird poem. And why did I pick this? I guess I picked this. I guess because it's kind of this time of year. It's called Postcard from New Hampshire, and it's written to some of my fellow raven lovers in New Jersey. So it's kind of addressed to them. Postcard from New Hampshire. I thought life here would be rife with ravens. They'd be lined up along the overhead wires like black bikinis on a rack at Macy's, daring me to bear some, be seen. They'd make me feel at home. But it's crows that shake me at 4 a.m., rattling the bony branches above the bat house and the dead maple behind the shed. They're the country version of car alarms. Here, we're not the drone of bees, but ATVs swell a summer afternoon. I don't romanticize country life. I'm no longer the kind of poet to put words in the beaks of birds. Winter's coming soon, and the closest I've come to raven speak is a New Yorker cartoon. And now I lied because, you know, I am, again, the kind of poet who puts words in the beaks of birds. So I actually put a little exclamation point next to that line. All right, so I'm going to end you because Thanksgiving's looming large ahead, guys. So this is my ode to turkey. And I'll end with this, and then if you guys want to talk, we can do that. And I'll show you my new exciting picture book quickly. So this is Ode to Turkey. It's a long, skinny poem, looks like that. Ode to Turkey. Because you run from your enemies, because you were named for a country that wasn't your own, because you're known to roam across a road as if it's a meadow, because the Mayflower, Indians, and pilgrims, because Ben Franklin proposed you be our national bird, because the eagle won out, because a herd of you will drown gazing skyward in a rainstorm, and Alexander Hamilton proclaimed no one should refrain from eating you each Thanksgiving day, because of your bluish red wattles and rusty tail tips, your gobble and bearded breast, because Mae West fed you her best beer before chopping off your head, because your head is naked and you'll attack the color red, because we dance the turkey trot and drumsticks keep the beat,
because some like whiskey over rocks and some like it neat. Because Norman Rockwell thought you worthy with a ladle full of gravy, but the owl will not touch you with your fan of feathers raised. I praise and will not eat you, wild patriot, fellow turkey, ugly fool of fowls.
I'm a vegetarian, so. So thank you, everybody. That's all I was going to read.